Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
In these days of the coronavirus, John and I are in separate places, both at home, but the show must go on. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month. But first, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Listeners might remember that last month I mentioned that our Prime Minister had talked about moving global Britain to galactic Britain. Maybe a little afar, but certainly low Earth orbit Britain anyway. And news on that front, just keeping it local as far as the UK is concerned anyway, the Shetland spaceport on the island of Unst in the Shetlands has rebranded itself. It's changed its name to Saxa Vord spaceport. Saxa Vord is the highest hill on Unst and also the name of the RAF radar station, the former station that's going to form the hub of the new site. It's a very suitable site because of its clear airspace launching into polar orbit from there. There's no land, no habitation on which rockets could fall in error. And it's all good news up there. 140 jobs are expected at the site, with a further 70 across the Shetland Isles. And indeed, there was mention of this in yesterday's budget. Some funding has been approved. But also another boost for this new spaceport is that on top of the existing arrangements with Lockheed Martin UK to launch from there, a new deal has just been signed with another British company based in Edinburgh called Skyrora. They are planning to launch starting next year using their own rocket called Skylark XL. That's a three-stage rocket, 22 metres high, and capable of putting 350 kilograms, that's plenty of small, tiny satellites, CubeSats and things of that sort, and they plan to build toward 16 launches per year from that site. So all of that good news. Well, we talk about space as being the final frontier, and at last Captain Kirk has actually got there. So I'm sure listeners will have seen this on the television news. But the actor William Shatner, who of course played Captain Kirk in the famous Star Trek series, has become the oldest person to get into space. This was aboard Blue Origin's second manned flight. The first one, of course, took Jeff Bezos up, and Jeff Bezos did this as a present to Captain Kirk, or in other words, William Shatner, who at 90 is amazing that somebody of that age getting up beyond the 60-mile barrier, which marks the edge of space as far as most of the world is concerned. And in the slides that accompany this programme, I trust listeners will be amused to see a picture that I found that tickled me. It's an organisation called News Thump have obviously picked up an original Blue Origin publicity photograph of the four crew, including Shatner, and have coloured them differently. The Blue Origin's uniforms are blue, as you'd expect. But this one shows everybody else in red, apart from Captain Kirk, who is in the Star Trek uniform of yellow. And those of you who watched Star Trek, and I'm sure that includes most, will remember what red means. And so the headline is, Blue Origin crew concerned by new uniforms ahead of Shatner spaceflight. So that tickled me. Well, we'll now move from one actor in space to another actor in space, but this time not on a suborbital hop, but properly in orbit. And this is Russian actress Yulia Perisild. She's been up on the International Space Station for a 12-day mission together with her director and cameraman, Klim Shipenko. And they have returned safely to Earth in their Soyuz on Sunday the 17th after their 12-day mission. The film that they've been making is called The Challenge. And the plot is that there's a cosmonaut on the ISS who falls ill, can't be returned to Earth until operated on. And so the surgeon has to go up to the ISS, which is her. And they used the real ISS commander, who is Oleg Novitsky, as the patient. So they've been filming a way up there and have now returned. He came down in the same capsule as the actress and the director. He'd been up in space for 191 days. But normally, if you've seen on television any Soyuz missions return, they help them out and they sit them on chairs, because after you've been in orbit, your muscles aren't working quite so well. But for them, there was no rest. It was straight back into acting mode, because the landing, of course, had to be part of the film sequence. And so she was straight back into acting role, with taking apparently several takes of her treating the patient as soon as he was removed from the capsule. So Oleg Novitsky, who's been in space for 191 days, no doubt really pleased to be back on Earth, had to be very patient as a patient and just lie there and be treated. And then, of course, they were whisked off after that was completed for their normal medical checks and debriefs. No definite date yet as to when Tom Cruise will shoot his movie on board the ISS. The mission he was due to go on was for this month, and that was a Crew Dragon from SpaceX, but chartered by another space company called Axiom. So that mission, Crew Dragon Axiom 1, was scheduled for October, but has had to be rescheduled for early 2022, and whether that will include Tom Cruise or not, I don't know. But a scoop there for the Russians. They've beaten the Americans to make a film in space. Well, of course, the International Space Station isn't the only space station up in orbit at the moment. The other one is the Chinese new space station called Tiangong, means Heavenly Palace. And that has just had a new crew. On the 15th of October, the Shenzhou 13 crew launched from the Gobi Desert and docked at Tiangong the same day on a fast transfer orbit. This is their eighth manned space flight and will definitely be its longest. They're going to stay in the space station for 6 months. Whilst there, they'll be conducting several spacewalks, and all of this is to prepare the station for the arrival of the next two large modules. So that's will triple the station's size. So it will still be considerably smaller than the ISS, but about the same size as the previous Russian space station, Mir. These will both launch, these two new modules, next year, when the next mission, the next crew is up there. That's Shenzhou 14. One of this crew is a lady that's already been in space for 14 days. She went up on the trial space station called Tiangong 1, and her name is Wang Yipin. And so she's going to she is the most experienced of this set of three cosmonauts, or as the Chinese call them, taikonauts. And she will be the first Chinese taikonaut to perform a spacewalk. On the 1st of October, we got some pictures back from Mercury. That's the from a spacecraft there. And that's the first time we've had fresh pictures of Mercury for quite a few years. So this wasn't a spacecraft in orbit. This is the European Space Agency's BepiColombo mission, making the first of what will be six flybys of Mercury. So these flybys are designed to slow the spacecraft and enable it to go into orbit around Mercury, but that won't happen until 2025. The problem of flying to Mercury is that you're heading from the Earth inwards, so towards the sun, so you pick up speed, and the problem isn't the speed in getting there, it's going too fast, and the problem is slowing down. So they use the gravity of the planet to slow it down, so swinging by it, gradually slowing it until it can go into orbit. So it's been on its way since 2018. And since then, it had the first of its slingshots around Earth, and then two past Venus. And the last of those was only 7 weeks ago. So it just took 7 weeks to go from Venus to Mercury. So that shows the speed it's travelling at. Unfortunately, as it passed Mercury at its closest, which was just 123 miles away, it was nighttime. It passed the dark, unlit side, so couldn't take any photographs. So the photographs were taken, one of which is in the slides, from a distance of about 600 miles. So this is a multi-part spacecraft. There's the transfer module, which is holding the other two. The job of that is to deliver the two separate probes to orbit, and then it'll separate. And that's got very large solar panels powered, ion, powering its ion thrusters. But the two working spacecraft will be the one from the European Space Agency and the other one from Japan. So the European one is called Mercury Planetary Orbiter, and that will do some detailed mapping of Mercury's surface and study the geology of that surface. And the one from the Japanese Space Agency is called Mercury Magnetospheric Orbiter, and that will study the influence of the solar wind upon Mercury. Dave, I bet in all the many years you've been doing your splendid programmes, I bet there'll be a record by the Beatles that you'll have played several times. And the one I'm thinking of is Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Now, I'll explain why I'm mentioning this. This particular song was playing over these loudspeakers at a... an archaeological expedition in Ethiopia many, many years ago, when they discovered mankind's oldest known ancestor, the fossil thereof. This was Australopithecus. And so because of the song and the fact that this was a young female, they called our ancestor Lucy. And that's a really old fossil, 3.2 million years old. Now, NASA have just launched the Lucy mission. Now, this is named after our Australopithecus because it too, the mission that is also after ancient fossils. These are fossils left over from the solar system formation. Now, these aren't the normal sorts of asteroids in the asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars. These are what are called Trojan asteroids. These are and something of the order of nearly 10,000 of these, and they're held in place in gravitationally stable points in Jupiter's orbit. So they're one set of them, one swarm, is at Lagrange point L4, 60 degrees to one side of Jupiter, and 60 degrees to t'other side is Lagrange point L5. And that is another of these gravitationally stable places. Stable because of the Sun's gravity and Jupiter's gravity. And so this particular mission is off to study this type of asteroid. As I said, remnants from the formation of the solar system. So not millions of years old, but 4-5 billion years old. Although there's near 10,000 of them that we've discovered from Earth, no space probe has been anywhere near them, so we haven't seen discovered any more that way. But it's thought that there's probably more than a million of these of about a kilometre or more in diameter. Now, to get out that far, the mission is going to make two flybys of Earth, gradually changing its orbit until the second one of those slings it out, heading off to towards Jupiter's orbit. And it will reach there in 2027 for a 15th month study. And quite fittingly, one of these asteroids is known as John Donaldson. Now, this was the archaeologist that discovered the ancient fossil Lucy. So it's really, he's had an asteroid named after him. So it's quite fitting that this will be the first asteroid studied by the Lucy mission. Then the spacecraft will head off back to Earth again, not to land. It's just to use Earth's gravitational pull, which will give it another impetus, heading off towards the other set of Trojans on the other side of Jupiter's orbit. Now, to travel out that far, we've got about half of the spacecraft fuel is made up of half of the spacecraft's mass is made up of fuel. That's because of the orbital changes that are required, and also to fire it away from Jupiter's orbit back into our part of the solar system. When it passes the eight target asteroids, five in one swarm, three in the other, it'll be travelling fast. It's not going into orbit, and it's at a relative speed, relative on average to these small asteroids, of about 15,000 miles an hour. So clearly it's got to adjust its position so its cameras are pointing as it speeds past. It'll also be the furthest a spacecraft has gone that is powered entirely by solar power. So to get solar power that far out, we've got to have massive great solar panels. And so these are the biggest solar panels that have been affixed to a spacecraft there. It's 16 metres across. There is a bit of a problem with them. One of the two panels has not quite latched itself into place. They're both generating power, so all of that is good. But the concern is if it's not quite latched into place, then when the spacecraft needs to tilt the panel to maximise the sunlight falling on it, it might not be able to do so. But NASA are quietly confident, I read, that they should be able to get that fixed. Couple of hot off the press items to finish with. First one is about not just one, but two private space stations announced within the last fortnight. First of all, on the Thursday the 21st, Starlab was announced as the name of a space station to be put up by a group consisting of NanoRacks, Lockheed Martin and Voyager Space. This is relatively small, mostly for space tourists, and is to be operational in 2027. And just a couple of days ago, Blue Origin, which of course is Jeff Bezos's company, announced that they were heading a group to also launch and build a space station much bigger than the Starlab one. That's going to be put up in the late 20s and to be operational certainly by 2030, hopefully before. The others in the group include Boeing and Sierra Space. The space station is called Orbital Reef, and its clients will include space tourists, but will also be national governments and private industry. And the plan is to use the Boeing Starliner capsule. You know, listeners will remember that's the alternative, the competitor, if you wish, to SpaceX's Crew Dragon, but hasn't as yet made its first manned flight. So that will be used to deliver crew, tourists, and cargo. Sierra Space is a company that I have mentioned a few years ago. They have a space plane called Dream Chaser. Now, that will initially be used for cargo. They have a crewed version of it, or at least in design, but NASA didn't accept that. It was put forward as one in the competition where Boeing's Starliner and SpaceX's Crew Dragon won out. But they say that for this operation, they could well build the crewed version of Dream Chaser and use that for crew. There is, of course, an existing plan that was announced earlier in the year for some private modules on the space station. These are to be put into place by the company called Axiom Space, an American organization. And those are planned to be installed in the ISS in 2024. But Axiom say that these will be detached at some point and will be completely free-flying or autonomous, you know, mini space stations. And of course, the ISS itself is going to be decommissioned sometime between 2028 and 2030. My last item is perhaps the most interesting, at least to me. It's quite a feat. In the past, I've talked about exoplanets. These are planets that we discover around stars elsewhere in the Milky Way. And usually they're found by dips in the optical light that is recorded as the planet transits across the parent star. Clearly it's blocking out just a tiny fraction of the light of that star. And so telescopes and instruments are so sensitive now that we can detect a planet in this way. And so far we know about 4,800 planets around other stars. But most of these, all of these are within our Milky Way and relatively close, within about 3,000 light years. However, believe that there is one discovered that is something the order of 28 million light years away. So that's well outside our Milky Way galaxy. In fact, it's in the Whirlpool galaxy, or Messier 51, as we know it. Now, this hasn't been detected in the same way. Researchers who were looking at a binary system in that galaxy that is believed to orbit a neutron star were using the Chandra X-ray observatory. This is a satellite several hundred miles out, about 800 miles out from Earth. And so they were looking at it in X-rays. And they witnessed a drop in X-rays from that star. Now, X-rays don't are unlike light. They don't X-rays come from a small portion generally of a star, and so if a planet were going across, not only would it reduce the emissions of X-rays, it could actually cut it right out. And I understand this is what is observed to happen. Now, this observation was actually made several years ago, I've learnt, and what they've been doing since is ruling out all of the other possibilities of what else could have caused this, like a cloud of dust in the way. And all of the other possibilities have now been excluded. And so the evidence suggests that this is an exoplanet in orbit around one of those two stars in the Whirlpool galaxy. Trouble is, the transit lasted 3 hours, so that suggests a large planet, perhaps the size of Saturn, but also it means that it's in an orbit that's about 70 years long. So it'll be another 70 years before scientists can observe this again and definitely prove that that was an exoplanet. But what an interesting discovery. Well, that's the last item, Dave, of my little look at things that have, I think, of interest in terms of astronomy and spaceflight for October.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
So what is the constellation of the month then, John?
For Constellation of the Month this month, Dave, our listeners are getting two for the price of one. That's both Pegasus, the winged horse, and Andromeda, the daughter of Cassiopeia. Well, they share a star called Alpheratz, so they might as well share a radio spot too. So there's some splendid Messier objects and also Caldwell catalogue objects in here. Galaxies galore, globular cluster, planetary nebula as well. So nice, easily found, and I hope that listeners will enjoy getting out and trying to find these two joined constellations. Well, night sky is looking good in November, Dave. We've got quite a few planets about, and more detail on those in just a short while. But let's look at the constellations, and let's start with the Milky Way. That's still riding high, virtually overhead, running from, well, roughly west to east. It's coming up through Cygnus, which is still with us, then rising up through Cassiopeia, which is almost overhead, going along through Perseus into Auriga, and tailing out a little bit as it goes just above Orion there. Orion is one of the best constellations to be looking at this month. That's up in the southeast by 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock mid-month. And just above and to the right of that, you've got the wonderful V shape of the Hyades cluster, which make up the face of Taurus, the bull. Other constellations well placed this month will also include Pegasus and Andromeda as well. So lots to be seen in the night sky. The moon, of course, will be there. Best time to see that is first quarter, a few days either side of the 11th, or if you're a morning person, either a few days either side of the 27th when it's a third quarter. And if you're into looking for fainter objects, then the moon is out of the way when it's new on the 4th, and on the 19th, a bit too bright as it's a full moon. We're, of course, back to GMT for November. So the sun is rising just before 7, on the 1st and rising later about 7:45 by the time the end of the month comes along. Setting earlier, of course, at the start of the month, it sets a little after 4:30, but by the end of the month, setting at 3:58. Planets. Well, they're pretty well mostly all visible. Mercury is there as a morning object in the east southeast. About an hour and a half is when it rises before sunrise, and is getting brighter as the month progresses. Venus is low as an evening object still, but very, very bright, shining at magnitude minus 4.7. So that's in the south-southwest, setting about an hour and a half after the sunset, at the start of the month, but later than that, 2.5 hours by the month end. Mars becomes visible again this month, but is a bit of a challenge in honesty. But that's in the southeast shortly before sunrise. But you've really got to pull it out from the twilight because it's not that bright as yet, but it will improve. Jupiter, still splendid there, but perhaps this is the last month really for finding it easily, because by the end of the month, that will be moving into the evening twilight. But very bright, magnitude minus 2.5, easily found in the south, and ideal to have a look at, particularly if you've got binoculars or a small telescope. But even binoculars should show you the four Galilean moons of Jupiter. Saturn, not too far away from Jupiter, a little bit lower, a little bit further to the right. So also in the south, but again, like Jupiter, moving towards the twilight. So make the most of them while you've got them this month. Probably the best placed planet is Uranus. But of course, that's one that isn't a naked eye object, and you've really got to know where to find it. But it's about 50 degrees high in the south. And use binoculars or a telescope to find it. Telescope definitely needed for Neptune, which is also well placed in the south again. Some interesting events during the month of November. Mercury quite close to the crescent moon. That'll be in the morning, so before sunrise, in the west-northwest. But the moon will be a challenge itself. It'll only be 3% lit, so a very thin crescent. And Mercury will be a bright spark, just 3 degrees away from that. On the 7th and also on the 8th, you've got two chances to see Venus very close to the thin crescent moon. But now this is in the evening, and so Venus will be to the left of the moon on the 7th, and to the right on the following day. I'm awfully sorry, I've just realised I said before sunrise in the west-northwest, that's east-northeast, because the sun sets in the west and rises in the east. Oh dear, oh dear. On the 8th, sorry, on the 7th, Venus will be to the left of the moon, and on the 8th, Venus will be to the right of the moon. On the 9th, Jupiter's largest moon, Ganymede, it will be passing across the disk. Now, that's not so easy to spot, but its shadow will be. Because it is the largest moon, it casts a big shadow, so you should be able to see that black little dot if you've got a telescope, so you're getting a reasonable-sized disk. And then you should be able to see that little black spot crossing the disk of Jupiter. So that's already underway as night descends, but the transit lasts until just a little after 6:30. The moon, still a crescent, but a much thicker crescent by the 10th, will just be quite close to Saturn, just sitting a little bit below Saturn on the 10th. And on the 11th, the moon will be just a little bit below Jupiter. And if you want to try and find that clair-obscur effect, the lunar X and the lunar Y, they can be seen on the 11th as well. About 10:30 it will be best. On the 17th, there's a meteor shower. That's the Leonids, which is usually quite a good one. But sadly, you won't see so many this time because the moon will be almost full that day. And so the brightness of the moon means that the fainter meteors just won't be visible. They'll be washed out by the light of the moon. But the brighter ones will still be seen. On the 19th, something else about the moon to tell you. There's going to be a partial eclipse. But it happens at dawn. So the fainter stage of the eclipse is called the penumbral stage. That starts at 6:02. So the moon, of course, by this time will be over in the west. And the darker part of the eclipse, called the umbral stage, that begins just a little after 7:15. Trouble is, the moon sets only about 20 minutes later. So if you want to see a little bit of this partial eclipse, you've got to be somewhere where you have a really good horizon. You can see all the way down to the horizon at the in the west. But hopefully you know somewhere somewhere suitable and can get there to see it. Well, clouds permitting, of course. Meetings at local societies. Now, some of our local societies are going back and holding physical meetings. Some are continuing on Zoom. So I can only really tell you about those that are of our local societies that are meeting physically. And I'm, in fact, giving a talk at one of these. That's Ewell Astronomical Society. They meet at Nonsuch High School for Girls in Cheam. And that's Friday the 12th of November at 8 o'clock. And that's a talk that I've done for quite a few societies now called Sputnik in Context. It's a bit of fun, but it's explaining how Sputnik, the launch, affected particularly America and galvanised them, in fact. Another society holding physical meetings is within our area is Croydon Astronomical Society. They meet at Trinity School at the Sanderson Room, also on the 12th of November at 7:30. They have Mark West Maquette talking about mindful stargazing. And a fortnight later, on the 26th at 7:30, they have Janet Taylor talking about the moon. However, some of our larger societies do open up their Zoom webinars to non-members. So on Wednesday the 17th of November, the British Astronomical Association have a webinar entitled The Fall, Recovery and Initial Analysis of the Winchcombe Meteorite. You might remember this was the one that landed on somebody's drive and was recovered very, very quickly. And so its material hadn't been damaged too much by the Earth's atmosphere. So an awful lot of scientific learning to be had from that particular object. So Wednesday the 17th. So the slides that accompany this programme will have the URL to point you in the right direction. Once their Zoom session gets too full, then you can, if you're too late to join that, you can watch on their YouTube channel instead. There's also a commercial talk you can listen to or watch. That's on Wednesday the 17th. 7:30 to 9:30. And that is via the company called Go Space Watch, and you book via Eventbrite. Just £3. The title is Voyager, from planetary spacecraft to interstellar probe. Listeners will remember that the Voyager craft, were the two of them, were the ones that visited the planets in the outer solar system from Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, and have now crossed the edge of the heliosphere. So by some definitions, that means they've left the solar system and are now heading out towards the stars. So that's NASA, somebody from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, a chap called Louis Mayo, doing that Zoom online talk. They've also got another one a week later, Wednesday the 24th, also at 7:30. And that's the marketing director from Spaceport Cornwall, doing a talk called Spaceport Cornwall, not surprisingly, Countdown to Launch. So both of those should, I'm sure, be of interest. And, of course, we can all be armchair astronomers and do a little bit of television watching. The Sky at Night, the programme is called Looking Ahead to the JWST. And their blurb says as follows: as the much-anticipated James Webb Space Telescope nears its launch date, Maggie and Chris look back at some of the incredible telescopes throughout history that have redefined our understanding of the cosmos. The team also looks at how the JWST could enable astronomers to unravel some of the biggest secrets of the universe. The JWST, the James Webb, is about to be launched from by an Ariane 5 from Kourou in the European Space Agency's launch pad in Guyana in South America. So that'll be exciting. So that's Sunday the 14th on BBC4 at 10 o'clock, and repeated Thursday the 17th, also BBC4, 7:30. But Sky at Night isn't the only astronomical programme on this month. We've also got Universe. That's Professor Brian Cox at it again. He journeys across the vastness of time and space, revealing epic moments of sheer drama that changed the universe forever. And the first episode has already started. That was on Wednesday, the 27th of October. And then there's a repeat on following Saturday. So it's every Wednesday, but with a repeat at 9 o'clock, I should say, on BBC Two, but with a repeat at 6:55, also on BBC Two on the following Saturday. So episode one is about the sun, episode two about the search for a second Earth, episode three, the Milky Way, episode 4, all about black holes, and episode 5, all about the Big Bang. So even though the first episode has now passed, do look for it on iPlayer and then catch up with the other live broadcasts. So there we are. That's what's up in the night sky and what we can see on television or meetings we could attend or watch for November.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insight. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items in that we couldn't fit into the broadcast.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.